Well, here we are, and it's the beginning of summer, and I'm just hoping that I just don't tip this too much. I think the feet are a little bit off kilter, and that's okay. We're in a new series, and you might have seen the promotion for the series last week. It's called The Rest of the Story. And many of you, in fact, I know I did. I grew up in a home, and we went to church on Sunday mornings. And when I went to church on Sunday mornings, I learned the big stories of the Bible. Anybody know some of the big stories of the Bible? I learned some of those big stories, and I wanted to pass it on to my children. So when they were smaller, now I don't read this to Julie and Jordan now because they're 11 and 8, and this is just not cool anymore. But we had the Big Ideas VeggieTales Bible Storybook. Anybody have that? Anybody actually currently have that? They're reading that to their kids? You know, a great little book in here. And this is a book where it has all the big stories. It has Josh and the Big Wall. It's got Gideon and the Tuba Warrior, or Gideon the Tuba Warrior. It's got Dave and the Giant Pickle. All those kinds of stories. And right from the beginning, even though you have Dave and the Giant Pickle, we know that's David and Goliath, obviously, right? We're learning the big stories of the Bible. We see those stories, we see some of those stories become motion pictures. We all know the famous, the Ten Commandments movie. We know some of the more recent movies that have come out, like Noah. We know movies like The Exodus or other movies like The Passion and Mel Gibson, the one that he produced. Of course, we have great people of the Bible. Great people, Abraham. I mean, we could just go down the list, right? Abraham and Gideon and Moses and David and of course Jesus and the Apostle Paul and so many characters that make up all these great stories. Great stories. We learn about God's timeless truth. Great characters. We learn about God's timeless truth through their experience. But what we want to do this summer is we want to say that, and many of us know this, is that we learn and we learn about God's timeless truth, and God's timeless truth goes so much, it goes so much deeper. It's through more than just the great stories or the great characters in the Bible. It is weaved right through Scripture. So what we want to do beginning today is we want to look at learning God's timeless truth through some lesser-known stories, and through some lesser-known characters. In fact, it might be lesser-known characters in lesser-known stories, and it might be some lesser-known characters in a few more popular stories. In fact, that's kind of what it's going to be this morning. So we want to take you on a road trip. Is anybody going on a road trip this summer? Anybody planning a road trip this summer? We have one person planning a road trip. Do you people go on holidays? What's going on here? I'm going on a road trip this summer. We're going to Carolina, right? And that's just what we're going to be doing, and we want to go on a road trip this summer as well. So we're going to kind of be all over the place in Scripture. So we just hope that you journey with us, and you just plan to be with us over these next several weeks. Let me ask you, have you ever faced a critical moment? Anybody ever faced a critical moment? I would think all of us at some point have faced a critical moment. All of us have faced a critical moment. In fact, critical moments, for some of us, critical moments begin the minute that the alarm clock goes off, don't they? Critical moments happen in our lives. Some critical moments are more critical than others. Some of us experience critical moments more often than others. It depends on where we are, age and stage, maybe what we're doing and what we're involved in, maybe for health-wise, whatever the case may be. We've all experienced critical moments. Now, let me just kind of give you a definition, because this is what we're going to be focusing on this morning. Here's how I would define a critical moment. A critical moment is where you find yourself in a challenging situation that's going to require that you make a tough decision that will ultimately affect you and most often will affect those around you, either in a positive or negative way. That's how I would define a critical moment. Maybe it's major career decisions. Maybe it's decisions that happen with your family. Of course, it was a critical moment for me when I needed to decide and make that decision to ask Amanda to marry me and for her to spend the rest of her life with me. That is a critical moment. That's a big decision. That's a major situation. We have two children. Many of you here have children. How many of you have gone through critical moments with your children? Absolutely. Your children might be grown up, but boy, you might still be going through those critical moments, whatever that may be. Raising kids, maybe it's something like responding to criticism. Maybe it's going through situations. Maybe it's not your job, but it's dealing with the people that you work with. Maybe it's something like purchasing big ticket items. Maybe it's what you're going to decide to do when that person just keeps tailgating you on the freeway. Because here's what critical moments do. They also work around, they also build our character. They help build and shape our character. They work with our character. Now, maybe for me, I love ice cream. I love the summer. Maybe a critical moment for you is deciding whether or not you want to go to a place like Menchie's or Dairy Queen. I don't know. And I don't know how critical that is because they're both good, right? I mean, it's those decisions that we have to make. All of us want to make the right decision. We want to experience the right outcome. But usually, folks, the right decision and the right outcome rarely comes through that path of least resistance, right? Some of us even compromise. We compromise the best for our lives because it's easier on us to choose the easy way. We don't necessarily want to choose the hard way all the time. That's just kind of our human nature. We want to choose the easy way out in many things. And I think that's sometimes the way we're wired. But here's the deal. Critical moments don't leave us with two easy choices. I want to say that. Critical moments do not leave us with two easy choices. When you get into a critical moment in your life, it's not just, well, win-win. Whatever I choose is going to be easy. It's going to be right. In fact, I would say rarely. In fact, maybe some of you are saying, man, when I'm in critical moments, it's never easy. It's never an easy choice. It's never an easy decision. It never leaves you with just two or more easy choices. So here's the question we want to focus on answering today. When you face life's critical moments, what's your game plan? When you face life's critical moments, what is your game plan to help lead you to the right decision? We all face critical moments. We all need to make decisions. What's your game plan? How do you work through them in order to help you to make the right decision and to be successful in those critical moments? John chapter 2. Verse 1 and 2 says this, on the third day a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. Jesus, at this time, he had a few disciples. He didn't have all his disciples assembled. His disciples, his LITs, okay, his leaders in training, he was pouring into these men, and they were together, and they were heading to the village of Cana. Now, just to kind of give you some understanding, you had Nazareth down here, okay, so you had the region of Galilee, you had the city of Nazareth, and then Cana was sort of a village in the hills. It was kind of hill country, and it was about 8 miles north or so of the city of Nazareth. So they're heading there. They're heading to a wedding. This is significant. All weddings are significant. Well, let's kind of go back into the context and figure out, okay, why is this wedding so significant? Weddings were huge back in that time. Tradition says that weddings were like one of these massive, huge parties. And here's what happened. If you were getting married to someone, if I was getting married to my wife Amanda, and we were back at, or to my, I was courting Amanda, and we were getting married, you would invite not your friends and family, you would invite the entire village. The entire village would come. Everyone would come to this celebration. And not only would it be for a day, you know how we go to a wedding and, well, they're getting married at 2, and then you go to Starbucks for a few hours because they're getting pictures taken after that, and then you show up to the reception for 6, and, you know, you're done sometime into the evening. Wasn't like that. Weddings would last, and receptions, the party would last for nearly 7 days. It was like a week-long affair. And it was the responsibility of the host to be able to provide the food, to be able to provide the drink, to be able to provide the wine throughout that week. Listen, some of you have gone through weddings. Some of you have just finished paying for your son or daughter's wedding. You know the cost of weddings. Imagine what it would have been like in those days. Major planning, major preparation, such a huge cost, such a huge commitment. Pretty amazing thing. It was an insult not to invite someone. You needed to invite everybody. You couldn't be selective. If I'm getting married, I can be selective. Isn't that a nice thing? They had to choose everybody. Everybody had to come. It was also an insult if you didn't show up to the wedding. Okay? So insult if you didn't get invited, but it was an insult if you didn't show up to the wedding. Jesus plans to show up, and he does. He shows up with his disciples. His mom is there as well. Now, look what Mary says. Mary says this in verse 3. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." Now we're thinking, are you kidding me? You have no more wine. Like, what's the big deal about this? Jewish tradition, Jewish wedding, week-long wedding, hosting the entire village of guests. It wasn't like, remember, this wasn't like, hey, you had an open cash bar. You've been to weddings with the cash bar. It's an open cash bar. You can go up and buy stuff or whatever, okay? It wasn't, they didn't have, you know, cases of Sunny Delight and pop and juice and bottles of water set aside for a few days later, right? They didn't have the plastic and the recycling and all that going on. No, they had water and they had wine. That's what they had. This was a huge thing. The expectation was that wine would be served throughout the week. See, they would serve the best wine at the beginning, and then once people started kind of getting, you know, a buzz, a little bit of a party buzz, and their senses started to dull, okay? In other words, they started to get drunk. They would add water. They would just dilute the wine, and they would just add water so it would last long. That was sort of the expectation. They served the best wine first and then diluted it. So all the wine's gone. What are they going to do? It's a major, major social faux pas, if you want to call it that. The bride and groom, and they don't even realize it, the bride and groom, this is crazy, okay? If you ran out of food or you ran out of wine, especially wine, you would be, what's the word? I guess maybe chastise or you would be embarrassed. It would be a shame thing that they would sort of put a sign over your head as husband and wife for the rest of your married life. That's what it would. Now that it was like breaking the laws, these unwritten laws of hospitality. That's what it was like in their tradition. So this was a huge deal. This was a major thing. This was a big critical moment that was coming down the pipe. And Mary finds herself, for some reason, in the middle of this. And what does she do? She decides to tell Jesus. Why? Why do we tell Jesus something? We know that Jesus is God, right? We know Jesus is the Son of God. Now, at the time, I think Mary had an idea about that, but was she really saying that? Was that the reason why? Listen, Jesus, I know you're the Son of God, so I want you to do something huge and miraculous and just blow everybody's socks off. I don't necessarily think so. But I think she had a bit of an inkling. The other reason why I think she would have told Jesus is simply this. Jesus is Mary's son. Tradition says that Mary's husband, Joseph, had already passed away at that point. So if you had a widow, okay, husband's passed away, you had a widow, and you had a son like Jesus, she would just be probably asking him to help her out in a lot of just normal everyday things. That was just sort of the expectation. He was sort of the go-to kind of guy when she needed help. So I think naturally she would turn to Jesus and say, Jesus, we got kind of like a crisis on our hands here. Whatever it was, she was resolute to make sure that Jesus knew the critical moment. And what I want to ask you is this. What do you do when a critical moment arrives in your life? What do you do when a critical moment decides to land in your world? Now, I get it. Life's good. Life's good. We've planned. We've prepared. We do everything we can to make sure that that we're living life as well as we can. We work hard to foresee potential problems, and we work hard to adjust to make sure that those potential problems don't catch up to us, that we remain in our sweet spot, that we work hard to be where we are. Life is good, only to find out from out of the blue there's no more wine. Have you ever been in that moment, that critical moment where it's like, there's no more wine? In other words, I find myself in this moment, and what I choose to do is going to have an impact on me, and it's going to have an impact on those around me. Mary didn't suggest to Jesus what he should do. She didn't have a dialogue with him. I find that really interesting. She didn't have a dialogue with him. They didn't sit down and have an argument. She didn't try to pitch her case, or she didn't try to direct Jesus. And very well, maybe she could have directed Jesus. There's a respect factor there. And after all, this is Jesus' mom, and she wanted Jesus to do something. I'm going to tell you what to do. There was none of that at all. Here's what she did. She demonstrated her trust in him by simply acknowledging him into the situation. In critical moments, do we acknowledge Jesus into the situation? Well, of course I do. I'm a follower of Christ. I'm a Christ follower. I want Jesus to help me through the situation. Do you acknowledge Jesus in the situation? It's funny when I think about this, because there are a lot of times when I've been in critical situations, critical moments, and I think I'm acknowledging Jesus in the situation, but what I'm actually doing is I'm actually giving Jesus my agenda. I'm dialoguing with Jesus. I want Jesus to know, yes, I want him to know how I feel, and that's okay, and it's okay to dialogue, but there's almost like a hidden agenda under there. I go through the critical moment, and for me, I'm thinking, what is the easiest, best, most advantageous solution that I can think of for me? And then all of a sudden I start praying for that. Is that a bad thing? No. But have I acknowledged Jesus? It's a heart thing. It's a motive thing. It's an agenda thing. You see, in life's critical moments, we must simply acknowledge Jesus in the moment. That sounds so elementary and so simple, but there's a fine line between doing the acknowledgement thing and then doing something like the requesting thing. And here's the fine line. Requesting, you still have a say in it. You want to get your opinion out. You have an agenda. There's a negotiation happening. Have you ever found yourself sometimes actually negotiating with God? Sort of negotiating the past, sort of negotiating the situation? Sometimes we get in that in critical moments, because critical moments never leave us with two easy decisions. So sometimes we're going to negotiate through that. Here's what acknowledging is. It's declaring God into the situation, and you minimize your input, and you establish God as the source of wisdom and as the source of direction. It's almost like taking a place of surrender. Are you allowed to talk to God? Are we allowed to dialogue with God? Do we want to tell God how we feel? Do we want to tell God our desire? Yes, we want to do these things, but again, it's deeper, it's at the root. What's the motive? What's the deeper picture? What's your agenda? You know, the amazing thing about it is when we actually acknowledge God, here's what happens. You're in a critical moment, and maybe you've been there in that critical moment. Isn't it amazing that when you're in those moments, you want to react? How many of you does it work out with you when you are in a critical moment and you just simply react to it? How does that work for you? A lot of times in critical moments, folks, we want to react and we're tempted to react to the situation, but the one thing we need to do is we need to take a step back, and the last thing we want to do is react. Acknowledging God in the moment causes us to take a step back. It causes us to keep from reacting. It opens up the bigger door and the bigger picture, and it lets God in the situation. We acknowledge Jesus, and that's what Mary did. And then Jesus says to her, and you're going to see. Can you just put that on there? I just don't have it in my notes. Verse 4. He says, "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My hour has not come yet." Kind of a stern thing. Now, understand, when he says woman, if I walk up to one of the ladies in the room and I say woman, it's just not good. You know what I mean? It's just not favorable. It's not a good thing. If I go up to my wife and I say woman, right? I just don't want to know what's going to come, right? But that was acceptable in that day. Not acceptable as in the way we look at it, but it was another way of saying, like a polite way of saying, ma'am. You know, he could have said mom or mommy or mother or whatever. It was a way of saying ma'am. It was a good thing. He wasn't insulting his mom in any way. And what he's saying to her, he's saying, whoa, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Let's figure out if this is our business here. And by the way, mom, I beat to a different drum. I know I'm your son, but I'm the son, I'm God's son. I'm the son of God. I beat to my father's drum, my father in heaven. It was a way of saying, I always acknowledge the father first. Isn't that cool? That's what Jesus did in the moment. He didn't overreact. He didn't react to the situation. He just didn't jump in and say, abracadabra, and there you go, and all the wine was there, and there was no issues. And no, he could have done that, right? He doesn't have to say abracadabra, by the way. But no, he makes it very clear and very straight to Mary, his mom. No, I'm on the Father's time. I'm on the Father's agenda, and I always acknowledge my Father first. Now, secondly, he's saying, this isn't the time and the place to start my public ministry. You see, Jesus had a time and a place that was right and that was perfect, and it was in the Father's timing, and as soon as that was going to start, it was going to end at the cross, and it was going to become a big public thing. And what he was saying to her is, this isn't it right here to make a huge public spectacle. But as we, most of us know the story, he does turn water into wine, but it's more in a discreet, private manner. Was that the answer Mary was looking for? I don't think she was looking for that. Now, I don't know what answer she was looking for. Maybe she was looking for him to jump in all guns blazing and they were just going to go and they were just going to do this and he was going to snap his fingers and everything was great. I don't think that's what she was looking for necessarily. But I don't know if she was so concerned about his response because it didn't matter. She was set on the fact that he was going to intervene in some way. How do you know? Look at verse 5. She didn't argue back. Mary just looked at the servants and said what? Do whatever he tells you. In life's critical moments, we acknowledge Jesus in the moment, but we also trust in his ability to act on our behalf. The path to the decisions we eventually make are influenced by how we acknowledge God and how we trust in his ability to do what only he can do in the midst of the situation. Listen, how much you let God in to the situation, to the critical moment that you're experiencing, how much you let God in will directly impact the decision that you eventually go with. She acknowledged Jesus, and she also had a steadfast trust in his ability that maybe it's not going to look the way, maybe that's not the response I wanted. Maybe it's not going to come out the way that I'm thinking. I don't think she really knew, but she knew that God would follow it through. She knew that Jesus would act and work and would see her through this situation. Verse 6, nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, and each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Now, they would hold that. They were not full, they were empty, but they would hold 20 to 30 gallons. You're wondering what the shameless plug is about. Let's take a look at this. Let's think about this for a second. You have these stone, Jeanette and I could not find stone water jugs that were that big, okay? So we had to go with the Home Depot things. 6 of them, 20 to 30 gallons. So let's think about that. 120 to 180 gallons, not liters, not milliliters, gallons of water. I have 40 of these buckets up here. If you were to fill every one of these 40 buckets, this would give us nearly 120 gallons. So think about the amount, okay? It's a little more than just kind of a cup of water. And that's what that's not only was it more than a cup of water, these things we put dirt in and we scuff them up or paint or whatever, but these stone jars back then were part of the ceremonial washing of hands. In other words, here's what happened. It was part of the Jewish ceremonial law. This is what they believed. They believed that as they did day-to-day things, And as they touched objects and day-to-day things, they would symbolically become unclean. So what would happen is you had these big stone jugs, and they were filled with water. And what you would do is you would go to this jug. So you would go to, I don't know, you go to whatever, and you would pour it on your hands. And what that meant is that you would become ceremonially clean. In other words, you would clean off all the bad potential influence from those things that you were touching. That's just the way it worked. That's the way they thought. That was their tradition. And you did that before you ate. So you washed off the bad influences associated with what you touched. These were jugs that were used to wash your hands and to clean you, symbolically speaking, to make you ceremonially clean so that you could go eat. They're at the wedding. Makes sense. That's where they are. That's what the people would do. Right now, the jugs are empty. Lots of water, okay? Lots of water. Verse 7 to 10 says this. He looks at the servants and he says, fill the jars with water. So they fill them. What did they fill them to? They filled them to the top. I mean, they were like this close from overflowing, right to the very top. Then he told them, draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. In other words, take it to your boss, the guy that's sort of organizing and running the show. They did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that he had churned into wine. He didn't even realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, obviously. Then he called the bridegroom over and he says, everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you saved the best wine until now. Put yourself in the shoes of the servant. We've learned from Mary. We know the story, the big picture. We know Jesus is the hero. But put yourself in the shoes of the servant right now. They're getting their cues from Jesus. They should be getting their cues from the master of the banquet. Red light goes on. They're told to fill up 180 gallons of water into these jars that are for ceremonial washing. Why is that an issue for these guys? That's like a violation of the law. You don't use that for anything else except to wash your hands. It's a ceremony. It's part of the law. You fill up as much water as you can. You fill them to the brim. Okay, Jeanette, if I was to ask you to fill up these buckets of water, and Andrew as well, here's what they're going to do. They're going to go and they're going to get some hoses, probably hook them out outside or wherever they have them around here, and they're going to fill these things. Now, is it going to take a few minutes? Yeah. But it's not going to take too long. Think about how long it would take a bunch of servants to fill up 6 massive stone jars that equals 180 gallons of water. That's going to take a little bit of time back in those days. They didn't have the hoses and all those kinds of, it just wasn't working like that. There's an issue. Wait a second, Jesus, isn't the problem with wine? Why are you telling me to mess around with water? That's kind of weird. Jesus, wait a second, you want me to draw some out and take it to my master. So what happens when my master finds out that I've been messing around with water and I've been messing around with these big stone jars? Oh, and by the way, you've drank something from them when it's strictly forbidden. Do you think they're going to be in good measure with their boss? I don't think so. This is a huge risk, and it came with huge consequences. Folks, these guys are servants. You know what these guys are? These guys are minions. You know what a minion is? Those guys. That's a minion. Yes, it's a minion from the movie Despicable Me. But you know what a minion is? Here's what a minion is, okay? There's an actual definition. It's a nameless, faceless servant. It's like an average Joe type person. They're minions. They're people who are doing their job. They're taking their cues from someone else. They're just doing what's demanded of them. They take a huge risk in the middle of a critical moment. Jesus says to them, guys, fill the jars. So what do? They fill them to the brim. Jesus asked them to take a glass to their boss. They did so. In life's critical moments, our trust in God is demonstrated by our obedience to God. Our trust in God is demonstrated by our obedience to God. Now, I was able to take Amanda and the kids to an all-inclusive resort down in Mexico, one of those kind of one or two times in a whole lifetime. And we thought, we're going to do this. Kids had a blast. They get down there. They called it free food every day. It's not free, but they thought it was free. And you get into the resort, and they serve you hand and foot, and you eat food. You participate in activities, and you eat more food. You go to the entertainment that they provide, and you eat more food. You go to the beach, and you eat more food. You go to the pool, and you eat more food. That's just what you just eat more food, and they're serving you, and everything seems free because you never had to pay there, although you're paying before and after. And you look, and you think, man, this is like a tropical breeze life. I could get used to this after a couple. Now, by day five, you're like, I just want normal food. But by day two, you're thinking, this is amazing. You're settling down. You're relaxing. You're into the mode. It's like tropical breeze living. How many of you know that we do not live in the tropical breeze kind of a life? Life's a lot more real than that. Life happens, and it happens. Sometimes it's beautiful and it's sunny. Sometimes the reality is it rains, storms come, days are hot, days are cold, it's cloudy. Life happens. Folks, we hit critical moments. But it's in those critical moments that each of us have a decision to make where we have to line up obedience versus comfort and convenience. Are we going to obey? Or are we going to take the easy way out? These guys could have taken the easy way out. They could have said no to Jesus. They could have just went to their master and said, here's what we're doing. It took courage, guys. It took a little bit of guts. It took a little bit of grit. It took a little bit for them to step in and say, man, I'm not quite sure how this is going to end up. It could end up really bad. I'm not sure what the outcome's going to be. I'm not sure exactly how this all works, but I'm going to do it. Kind of sounds like life when we're in critical moments. Your trust in God is demonstrated by your obedience to God. Yes, we pay lip service. All of us. If I said, hey, put up your hand if you trust Jesus. Yeah, we trust God. We trust God. We intellectually, we trust God. But here's what happens. Sometimes God says, fine, I'm going to call your bluff. I'm going to call your bluff because you say you trust me and you're in this critical moment. I'm going to call your bluff. Here's what's going to happen. If you say you trust me, you need to demonstrate it by taking a step of obedience and taking a next step. And let me tell you something. There's never two easy decisions. Sometimes that's how God works. Sometimes that's how God helps us step forward in our faith and helps us step forward in growth. He calls us on it. And these guys, man, they stepped forward and they went into the unknown and they did it and they just trusted in the person that told them to do it and they kind of acted on obedience. And what happened as a result? Water was turned into wine. Water was turned into the best wine because that's what when Jesus works on our lives, folks, he's doing the best. He's not going to give us the backup. He gave them the choice wine, the best wine. And they gave them enough wine to fill up 2,000 4-ounce glasses for people. Of course, Jesus is the hero of the story. But man, kind of learn some good spiritual truth about those little minions in behind the scenes, don't we? You see, our trust in God is going to be demonstrated by our obedience to God. I'm going to ask right now those who are preparing to serve communion, if you could just head on out to the back there and then just make your way up. That would be awesome. You might have seen this on the Pepsi or on the table. It's Pepsi. I've told you before, if I do experiments, I always do it with Coke because I never waste a good bottle of Pepsi. Okay? Pepsi. I know, I hear booze. It's okay. You people will come around at some point. When I take this bottle, when I take this can of Pepsi, I go to the store, and it's amazing when you go to the grocery store how you find a lot of a lot of different brands, don't you? A lot of different brands of the imitation cola. But here's the deal with Pepsi. If I want Pepsi, what do I have to do? What do I have to do with Pepsi? If I actually want this Pepsi, guys, you can just take a seat. Just take a seat on the front there for a second if you can find room, because I actually will just be another minute. It's okay. I got to go buy Pepsi, right? Some of us, we say, listen, I want the experience of Pepsi, but I don't want all the ingredients in Pepsi. So what do? They have other options. They have Diet Pepsi. They have the caffeine-free Pepsi. They even have this Pepsi with stevia sugar, something like that in it, right? And that, okay, that's fine, that's good enough. But if I want, and they might even sort of taste like Pepsi, but if I want Pepsi, if I want to have the real Pepsi experience, what do I have to do? I got to buy Pepsi. I can't compromise. But some of us, we just want to compromise and we want to go with the stevia, or we want to go with the caffeine, or we want to go with the Diet Pepsi. Some of us in our Christian lives, we choose the Diet Christianity. You want to know what Diet Christianity is? Diet Christianity is all the benefits of Christianity, but with no hard work added. Take those ingredients, take those things out. We'll take the good stuff. Folks, when you go through and when I experience critical moments in our lives, we have the choice to make. Is it comfort and convenience, or is it obedience? And here's the deal. You can choose comfort and convenience, but you will never experience God's best for your life. Because God desires to work through you in everyday life when the sun is shining, when you're down in Mexico and you're taken in the sun. But God really desires to work through you and grow your faith in Him through those critical moments when you are forced to make a tough decision. And not only are you forced to make a tough decision, but at times you think, I don't even know what decision to make. Why? It requires you to acknowledge God in the situation in an authentic way, to surrender. It requires you to trust in His ability that He will see you through, that He is moving and acting and working on our behalf, because that's what His Word says. And it requires us to trust Him. And when we trust Him, we're going to have to respond and act in obedience to Him. I don't want to live the Diet Pepsi life, or the Diet Christianity life. I want the real deal. I want the real thing, because I know that, yes, we go through the turmoil, we go through the hard things, but I know that when you get to the other side of those things, 10 times out of 10, you always say, man, I'm glad I did it. Man, I'm glad I made that decision. You never, ever regret going in obedience, because it's at those moments when you are in the sovereign hand of God. Critical moments. What's your game plan? What's your game plan?